Case number 14-5018, Jacqueline Halbig, et al., appellant versus Kathleen Sebelius, in her official capacity as U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, et al. Mr. Carvin for the appellants, Mr. Deliri for the appellees.
So I guess this is the group that couldn't get into First Street this morning?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Good morning. Michael Carvin for the appellants. This is a very straightforward statutory construction case where I think the plain language of the statute dictates the result. And the only two provisions of the Act explaining which insurance exchanges are eligible for the federal subsidies, it states quite clearly that the insurance...
Can we get to a threshold issue here? And is it pronounced Mr. Clemenchik?
Clemenchik, yes.
Clemenchik. Does he have an adequate remedy in a tax refund suit?
No, he doesn't. For the same reason, he didn't have an adequate remedy in NFIB. The court in NFIB could have said to him, well, just pay the penalty and come back in a couple of years and contest it then. But they didn't. What they said was, because the AIA doesn't apply, that the ban on pre-enforcement suits, pre-enforcement challenges to the collection of taxes, is not applicable. I don't even think that the government doesn't argue that the AIA applies, and therefore it can't be that equitable principles foreclose them, because otherwise the AIA would be a non-entity. It wouldn't mean anything. Thirdly, under the basic principles of Sackett versus EPA, Abbott Labs, Mr. Clemenchik would be facing the dilemma of either having to pay a penalty or conforming his behavior to what he considers an illegal command. And the entire point of pre-enforcement review is to make sure that plaintiffs don't have to face that Hobson's choice. And then to return to the merits, if I could, the language in the provisions defining the remedies is relatively straightforward, and indeed as clear as could possibly be. You need to make a purchase on an exchange established by the state under Section 1311. So it clearly does not include purchases on exchanges established by HHS under Section 1321. The government can't offer any rational explanation of why the subsidy provision says precisely the opposite of what they contend is the rule. Why would they exclude HHS? Then they make this argument that it's sort of an odd place to put the restriction on the exchanges, but it's not that at all. It's not an elephant in a mouse hole. Again, these restrictions are in the only two provisions that define and delimit the kind of purchases that are subject to...
Does our precedent allow us to conduct a Chevron 1 analysis by looking at the text alone? Doesn't Sierra Club say that we can't arrive at the decision whether the text is clear by simply looking at the text? Do we have to look at structure, purpose, legislative history? Is that the analysis we're supposed to follow here?
Chevron prong one is, has Congress spoken precisely to the question at issue? If the statutory language is completely unambiguous, then that should be the end of the matter. But I don't want you not to look at the structure or context, and I want you very much to look at the structure or context. The context, the first point I was making is, this is the provision that deals with the precise question at issue. Are these subsidies available? Everyone agrees that purchases that are not made on exchanges are not subject to the federal subsidies. Well, the only reason we know that is because of the precisely the same provisions I'm pointing to. The government agrees that if you buy insurance off the exchange, you can't get a subsidy. But the only reason we know that, again, is these two provisions. The context, if you will, is, were they treating the word state as a synonym for all exchanges? Let's look at the context. Throughout the Act, they use phrases like exchange under the Act when they're trying to get at both kinds of exchanges. They use the word exchange. In 36B itself, the subsidy provision, it recognizes that there's two kinds of exchanges, 1311 exchanges and 1321 exchanges. So I'm not running from the context. I think it's very much...
You're referring to the reporting requirement?
Okay, yes.
I mean, when you say that the 36B...
Yes.
Right. But that wasn't part of the statute of the Affordable Care Act, was it? That was added afterwards.
That was added by HSEER. That's correct. Right. And my only point is it shows a general congressional awareness. I'm not attaching a lot of significance to otherwise it confirms the obvious, which is they knew there was two kinds of exchanges. They knew there was 1311 exchanges, and they knew there was 1321 exchanges, one established by the state, one established by the federal government. And yet when they sat down and said, where are subsidies available, they limited it to those established by the state under Section 1311.
Well, let me raise some questions if I can. I have parsed as carefully as I can through the legislative history and anything that indicates a purpose of Congress, individual mandate, is one of the critical prongs of the statute. I can't find anything in the statute, legislative history, or purpose to indicate that Congress meant to create a connection between state-created exchanges, the availability of subsidies, and the enforcement of individual mandates. You argue that they have these provisions as they do because it's an incentive for the states to set up exchanges to ensure that their citizens will receive a subsidy. Is that your argument?
Sure. In other words, they conditioned...
Is there something to indicate that that's what they intended to do, other than you're asserting it?
No, there's three things. First of all, we know they did it for the same reason they know they conditioned Medicaid.
No. Is there something in language or legislative history that says they meant to set up the statute this way as an incentive to encourage states to set up exchanges?
There is three things, all of which are the same as Medicaid. One, they limited the subsidies to situations where the state had established the exchange.
Your proposition simply assumes the answer to the question, so that one is gone. What's the next one?
They said you shall set up exchanges. It commands it. So what's the penalty if you don't adhere to the governmental command? The penalty is you don't get the subsidies. So we know very much that they wanted state money.
You don't get the subsidy?
I'm sorry?
Who is the you?
The people in the state.
The people in the state. Now,
correct.
You're representing people, as I understand it, who you claim in large numbers, both employers and individuals, who neither want the employer assessment nor the mandate, nor the subsidy, because it will invoke the individual mandate.
Correct.
So why? How can you logically argue that states have an incentive to set up exchanges if large numbers of people in the state don't want them?
I never suggested...
Under your theory?
The theory is they would be getting hundreds of billions of free federal dollars.
Who would?
People in the state.
But not the people that you're purportedly representing. Large numbers of employers and individuals, you argue, want no part of this. So the state has no incentive. If it's a political look, the state has no incentive to set up the exchanges because there are large numbers of voters and supporters who don't want any part of it if your theory is correct.
Judge Edwards, we're not asking what my attitude is about these things. We're asking what the proponents of the Act theory was, and they did view...
You're the one who is arguing that Congress did this to create an incentive. When I read that argument, to be very honest with you so you can know where my concerns are, it seems preposterous. I don't understand how the states have an incentive to set up an exchange, and especially where there's evidence to indicate the reason Congress left it this way as opposed to Medicaid is some states didn't want to be bothered setting up the exchanges. They let the feds do it. What do they care? It had nothing to do with this is an incentive. This is a carrot for you because then subsidies will follow because there are lots of people in the state who don't want the subsidies.
First of all, no one who passed the act thought that there was a whole lot of people who didn't want their health care paid for. That is as atextual and as counterintuitive as is possible. No one thought giving people $150 billion to go buy valuable health insurance was something that the people would rise up and say, don't do this. So you can't transport whatever my idiosyncratic views are to the proponents
of
the
act. Which people are you talking about?
I am talking
about the poor people, right?
Well, no, the government makes the excellent point that it's not just the poor people who would be adversely affected.
The people who would benefit from the subsidy. We don't know. Are the numbers equal, the people who would and would not?
I'm sorry. Yes, obviously anyone who gets the check, who is not in the situation of Klemenchik, but we're not talking about those people either. We're talking about states who are being told you can either have a very valuable benefit provided to you or not. If you're going to articulate the theory that this is not a valuable benefit, then the government's purpose argument goes away. Because then there is no purpose in distributing these benefits because Congress didn't care if these subsidies were there. But their argument is Congress was so devoted to distributing these subsidies as widely as possible, you were to ignore the plain language in the subsidy provision that conditions those subsidies.
So here's the problem, here's the problem I'm having, Counselor. As far as I can see, no one understood what you're arguing now at the time this bill was passed. It's not like Medicaid. Let me finish my question, okay? Because this is the part that just leaps out.
Sure.
It's so obvious. No one understood this. No one assumed that this was the effect of the act. That is, you're giving the states, as with respect to Medicaid, an opportunity to gut a benefit provision. And this is a critical provision. Medicaid, Congress knew how to do it if they wanted to. They said, you pick it or not, and if you don't, we understand, so be it. No one assumed that if you choose not to create an exchange, because you don't want to be bothered with it, you'll effectively gut the statute. I mean, one of your amicus briefs says, hey, that's why we're here. We want to gut the statute.
Terrific.
Congress doesn't talk about something like that, if that's what their purpose is, gut the statute provision. Hello, where's that coming from?
Congress talked about the consequences of the state turning down the subsidies here as much as they talked about the consequences of them turning down Medicaid. There's not a scintilla of legislative history.
The Medicaid provision is explicit on its face about the gutting possibility. That's not clear here.
That is completely untrue.
You have a provision that can be read either the states don't want to be bothered, let the Fed set up the exchange. There's no language to indicate that the failure of the state to do it will effectively gut the statute.
May I clarify the Medicaid provision? The Medicaid provision doesn't say anything about your aid is conditioned. All it does is add an additional eligibility criteria to the addition ones. It said you must go to 133%. It doesn't say if you don't take this deal. They point to 1396C as somehow putting the states on notice. But if you read 1396C, it has nothing to do with whether or not turning it down you lose your Medicaid eligibility. It's all about after you've accepted the deal, if you get in a fight with HHS. It says you can lose your Medicaid funds if the plan has been so changed that it no longer complies with the provisions. And it says that in the administration of the plan, there's a failure to comply substantially with the act. So it has nothing to do with putting states on notice that if they say if they don't satisfy the eligibility criteria, they are not satisfied. It is precisely parallel in the statute. 1396C, by the way, was not added by the Affordable Care Act. So no, you have precisely the same.
So Sierra Club, if we follow the reasoning of Sierra Club, we're supposed to look at legislative history. Is there anything in the legislative history, any floor statements, any committee reports, that you can point us to that show that this was on the mind of Congress? In fact, is anyone making this point before Professors Adler and Cannon come up with it?
Yes.
Who, where, when? And not Chairman Baucus. Sorry. You've overread that one. So that doesn't persuade me. But
Professor Jost made exactly the proposal, a very influential comment. The HELP Committee, the other committee that was looking at this act, conditioned subsidies on them making certain.
Which state does Professor Jost represent?
If we're talking about representatives on the floor, I have
Sierra Club says look at legislative history.
Yes.
There's a traditional way to go about doing that, and it's committee reports and floor statements, right?
Yeah.
That's what we.
Yeah. I was getting the help.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The help. Yeah. The bill there condition subsidies on the states making certain insurance reforms.
That didn't make it into law, did it?
No, but I thought you were saying that. Well, I think.
Yeah, they did that, but they said that that would be, they deny subsidies unless the state set up an exchange for, and they, the denial would be for 4 years, right?
That was one part of it, but the second part, Judge Randolph, was they would be denied subsidies forever unless they applied the employer mandate to state and local government.
Right.
So it was a different condition.
There's a statute in the Internal Revenue Code right near where this one is found, and it's 26 U.S.C. Section 35.
Right.
Which is a health care subsidy provision.
Right.
But it was limited to people who lost their jobs in manufacturing overseas.
Right.
Or lost their pensions in the pension crash. I've read that statute. That statute reads almost identically to the statute we 36B, the one that you're arguing about. And it's clear as a bell there that the state residents, citizens, don't get any subsidies. I think it was 72% to pay for their health care, unless the state goes through a whole bunch of hoops and enacts a bunch of different laws and so on and so forth. And if the state doesn't do it, then the people don't get the money.
Right. And they put that.
So they copied. I mean, it's a typical drafting thing in Congress. If you've already done it once, what you do is you take that provision and you copy it into the subsidy provision of the Affordable Care Act. It's clear that's what happened.
And
they use the same terms, coverage month, eligible individual.
That's exactly right. Well, the condition is contained in a section called coverage month. I think it's very relevant that the principal sponsor of that was Senator Baucus. So it wasn't just a coincidence. It was the same people drafting the finance committee thing who had a clear model for all of this, showing that, and again, I don't think there was a whole lot of...
How did all the states miss this?
None of them.
They didn't miss the Medicare condition. They challenged it as unconstitutional. They knew exactly what was intended there. No state, and indeed one of the briefs points this out, no state made the equation that the availability of subsidies was a factor in deciding whether to create an exchange. No one. This came out of the blue. I mean, you know, it's your job as an attorney. Someone figured out a strange argument. Let's run with it. We can find this language here, and it'll gut, your amicus says, it'll gut the statute.
I hate to contradict my distinguished colleague, but it was widely known that unless the states set up an exchange, they weren't going to get subsidies for their citizens. And, in fact, there was an editorial in Investor's Business Daily in September of 2011 that pointed that out. And the Texas congressman knew it. They sent a letter to Speaker Pelosi complaining about it. I mean, it was clear.
35 senators opposed the IRS rule on the grounds, 35 members of Congress opposed it on the grounds that it was not compliant with law. They couldn't have sued under NFIB because it didn't become effective until 2013. That was the date at which the states had to opt to make the decision.
I'm asking, what was the evidence, and I think my respected colleague is not addressed it either. There was no evidence at the time this bill was passed that this was the consequence. No one assumed this. No one. Something like this doesn't hide away, and then people all of a sudden, oh, my goodness, look what we have. No one assumed, as with respect to Medicaid, that there was this connection here and that you could effectively gut the statute.
With
the other reading, there was also plenty of evidence out there that the, and in fact, I think folks on your side in one of the cases commented on, look how nice Congress was. They allowed the states to, you know, take the trouble to set up an exchange or let the feds do it. Either way, never making the connection that it had anything to do with the availability of subsidies.
That makes my point, Judge Edwards. Everyone knew there was a condition in Medicaid. There's not a scintilla of legislative history confirming that truism. Why? Because people can read statutes. And if a statute says you don't get Medicaid unless you increase your eligibility, everyone knows it. They don't need letters from senators to governors. And the court has consistently instructed us that we don't psychoanalyze what members of Congress thought. We look at what Congress enacted.
You look at the whole statute.
That's true. And let's say
the whole statute. What information you have to require, Whether there are other provisions that work differently, obviously work differently. The Medicaid provision is not the same as this provision.
It is, except it's more draconian consequences if the state says no. And if a state had said no, and some litigant had come into court and said, you know what, this is terrible in terms of the consequences. We've just eliminated the most important social welfare program of the last 50 years, so we want you to read the condition out of the statute. And we point out that there was no legislative history. No court would take that argument seriously. NFIB struck down that provision. It was obliged to give it a savings construction, and no one on the court suggested that was remotely plausible. That is because we look at what the statute says, what was enacted by Congress, and if there's no reason to interpret the language differently than what it says, because there is no absurdity, as there concededly is not here, that is the end of the judicial law. We don't go around asking how much awareness there was, particularly in a context where, let's face it, they had 6 days to debate this in the Senate.
There are absurdities here.
Excuse me?
There are absurdities here.
Which ones?
The one they
point to is the qualified individual, okay? They say, look, it says you have to be reside in the state that established the exchange. And they say that's absurd because that would mean nobody could reside on federal exchanges. But we know that's not a consequence of our interpretation of 36B. How do we know that? Because the government agrees. If this court agrees that 36...
That's not even an anomaly anymore because they passed a regulation that nobody's challenged that defines qualified individual as anybody on any exchange. So it's a non-issue. It's not an anomaly. It's certainly not an absurdity. There's a regulation out there that takes care of the problem. And nobody's challenged it, unlike this one.
And if I could just elaborate on that point, Mr. Delery's not going to stand up here and tell you that if you rule our way on 36B, that they will be obliged to revise that regulation and exclude everybody from federal exchanges. Even more importantly, our argument on why it doesn't create absurdity is because it only says you need to be a qualified individual with respect to an exchange. And an exchange is defined in the Act as an exchange under 1311, i.e. state exchanges. So this requirement only applies to state exchanges. Please read their opposition brief. They don't dispute that in any way, shape, or form because they know that this requirement only applies to state exchanges because they're not going to suggest this absurd result. So what they're trying to do is take a tendentious litigation position on the qualified individual provision so they can create this fake absurdity and then transport that absurdity and that rewriting of the language to 36B where it is conceded that there is no absurdity. In terms of the other anomalies of the Act, they simply don't exist. They say the Medicaid maintenance of effort requirement, which requires you to maintain your Medicaid standards until there's a state-established exchange, creates some kind of absurdity. No. The government itself says the purpose of that is to freeze all Medicaid payments until the subsidies from the ACA come in to replace them. Well, if we are correct that the subsidies don't exist on the state exchanges, that simply means they're going to freeze...
No, on the federal exchange.
That they're going to freeze those until they create a state exchange. In other words, precisely the reason that they give. Plus which, of course, it gives the states another incentive to create the state exchanges. So in that way, they could then modify their Medicaid. So there's no absurdity there. They point out the reporting requirements in 36BF3, which, as Judge Randolph pointed out earlier, came from the House. We're stuck into this provision, which is why there's a bit of a disconnect between the title of the provision and the absolute language of the provision. And 36BF3 says that it explicitly recognizes that there's a difference between 1311 and 1321 exchanges. So it completely refutes their notion that somehow Congress thought state was a synonym for 1321 federal exchanges. They say it's odd.
The notice of proposed rulemaking also recognized that if you look at the notice of proposed rule rulemaking, it says we interpret established by a state pursuant to 1311 to mean established by the federal government pursuant to section 1321. That's what the proposed, we're reviewing a rule here, And that's the notice of proposed rulemaking.
That is the government's position. It's also the government's position on the funding mechanism. The funding mechanism says it only goes to exchanges established by the state. Well, HHS doesn't draw on those funds for its exchanges because it knows that when the same provision talking about funding says established by the state, that that's what it means. And they didn't want to get crosswise with Congress when they tried to dip into a fund that was reserved exclusively for the state. So even the government doesn't believe their own argument. At the end of the day, what they're trying to tell you is that it's unreasonable or irrational or not the purpose to limit some states to not have subsidies. I agree. If we were arguing that there was something in the Act that said these states don't get subsidies, they'd have a point. We're not making that argument. We're making the argument that they condition subsidies on the state creating the exchanges. So what they have to argue is that was irrational. But we know it's not irrational for three reasons. That's what they did with Medicaid. They very much wanted state-run exchanges. The only real incentive for the states to run the exchanges was by conditioning subsidies. The alternative policy under the IRS's rewriting of the rule creates a bizarre circumstance where it's almost impossible to fulfill the Act's purpose of having state-run exchanges because it eliminates any tangible incentive for these people to go ahead and adopt the exchanges. So they've created a situation which predictably has resulted in only 14 states doing what Congress clearly wanted 50 states to do, which is to set up their exchanges.
So in other words, your argument is that but for the IRS rule, it may well have been that the implicit prediction of, quote, Congress, that all the states would buy into and set up their own exchanges, it didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is because the IRS rule came in there and the states said, there's nothing in it for us now. I mean, let the federal government do it.
If the D.C. government said, you get $100 if you clear the sidewalk in front of your house of snow, or you get $100 if you don't clear the sidewalk in front of your house of snow, there'd be a whole lot of snow on the sidewalks because they've utterly eliminated the incentive to take the desired action. And the same is precisely true here. The calculus of Congress was we will only achieve less than 50% state participation if states behave in the economically irrational thing of denying hundreds of billions of dollars of free federal money. It's not like Medicaid where they have to chip in about 43.
What is the advantage? Your proposition is just assuming the answer to the issue, which is, I don't know what to say. I keep listening to it over and over again. You just assume the answer and then you run with that. Why does it matter who creates the exchange? Now forget your alleged tie to the subsidy. Okay.
How do we know it matters to Congress?
Why does it matter?
Because they said states shall run the exchange. They gave the strong.
And they said, and if they don't, it'll be done by the feds.
Exactly. But what
they didn't say, oh, it's a bad thing that it'll be done by the feds. They said, if the states do it, a governmental agency or nonprofit entity established by the state, and HHS will establish the exchange when the state fails to do it. Isn't such an exchange an entity established by a state?
Yeah,
established by the state?
They wanted states to run the exchange.
No. Isn't there an ambiguity there? If you read that language, the state shall, and if not, the feds will, that is an exchange established by the state. Can't the government say that's the way we're interpreting it when you look at the purposes of the Act?
No, not at all. You can't interpret state to mean federal. You can't interpret north to mean south.
What advantage is there to a state as opposed to the Fed setting up the exchange? Forget the subsidy.
To get reelected. Do you want to go out and tell your citizens, I have just denied you hundreds of billions of...
No. You have to forget the subsidy. See, you keep asserting the proposition in a way that it's the answer to your question. Forget the subsidy. I'm trying to understand, because I've thought about this a lot. Your argument makes no sense. Who cares who sets up the exchange?
Ben Nelson.
The enactors
Ben
of the
Nelson
Act.
Care.
Who cares?
Ben Nelson.
They couldn't get to 60 unless Ben Nelson said, we are not going to have a federally run exchange. We are going to implement basic principles of federalism, and the states are going to run those exchanges, or I don't vote for it.
Okay.
It doesn't get
and
passed.
Then what Congress
now,
did
then
was
what Congress
set
did
up
was,
and let me give you my question.
Sure.
Then what Congress did, forgetting the subsidies, is they set up this arrangement.
Yes.
The states can do it if you want to do it. If not, we'll do it.
It said the states shall do it, and if you don't, we will do it.
And
that tells you that they wanted an exchange in the state. But it doesn't, but they preferred a state-run exchange.
My question, forget the subsidy.
I am forgetting.
Who cares other than the one person you've named? What difference does it make who sets up the subsidy? There is evidence. There's no evidence coming from the states supporting what you're suggesting. And there is evidence that some states were happy to let the feds do it. They didn't want to be bothered.
If that was true, that they were happy to have the feds do it, and the feds wanted the states to do it, that means you needed to provide them with a pretty big incentive. And the best and most closely drawn incentive for them to do what they were unwilling to do, but Ben Nelson and the Act wanted them to do, was to say, I'll give you hundreds of billions of dollars to your voters if you do it. Now, if you say no, you're going to have to go back to those people, of all income strata, and to all those businesses who are adversely affected,
irony,
and you have to tell
irony,
them.
The great irony in your argument is you're standing there representing the employers and the folks, and you claim there are many, many, many of these folks in many, many, many of these states
I
who
never
want
said
no
that.
Part of this, and they are voting too. And then on the other side of your mouth, you're saying, well, but this is a great incentive for a state to set up the exchange because they have to go back to those voters. They don't want to give up that money. Well, you're saying there are lots of those voters who want no part of this.
Judge Edwards, with the greatest respect, surely the interpretation of a statute can't turn on what the plaintiffs think or believe. Surely if I had a supporter of the act coming in here.
I'm just taking you at your word. You start your argument. The crux of your argument is there was an incentive for the states to do that. I'm reading this stuff really carefully. That argument from day one has made no sense to me whatsoever, given who you're representing and given the number of people you say you represent who want no part of this. So the state, acting politically, is not clearly going to say, let's set up an exchange.
Judge Edwards, let's assume one of two.
If Congress gives them an option to set it up or not, they're going to say, let's not do it, because there are a lot of people in the state who don't want any part of it.
Okay. There's two propositions. One's the states are reluctant to set up the exchanges. If that's true, then you need a very large incentive to get them to do it. Number two is
only
the state.
Only if it matters. Only if it matters. Who does it?
They wanted the states to run the exchanges.
Because
they said shall run, because they needed Ben Nelson's vote to pass the act, and because
I'm not getting it. Okay. If you take the subsidy out.
Yeah.
Of the equation.
Right. Then you get.
I know I've asked this seven times. Mm-hmm. I'm asking it again. Take it out.
Right.
You have a provision that says state will do it or the feds will do it. What difference does it make who does it? Forget the subsidy.
Because if you have the feds running it, it is the first step, to quote Senator Nelson, towards a federally run health care exchange. We want to ensure that we have state participation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to speculate about whether Senator Nelson's views prevail, because you can look at the Act. And the Act says two very explicit things. The states shall do it,
mm-hmm.
which is hardly agnostic as to whether or not the states will do it. And two, only the states will get money to set up the exchanges. We won't give any money to the federal exchanges. So I've never mentioned the word subsidies, and that's how you know they wanted states to run exchanges.
Your argument also is rather broader than that, because the pattern, the model, the system that this sets up is a very familiar one. The Clean Air Act, the Water Quality Act, and all of those provide that if the state doesn't set up a state implementation plan, the federal government will take it up. It matters a great deal to the states to have control. But life's a trade-off, and this statute is rather Janus-based. I mean, it's looking in about 15 different directions on every other page, cobbled together, poorly written, but there it is. And it is modeled, I think, over on 26 U.S.C. Section 35, and that also condition subsidies on states enacting laws, and that's what we're dealing with here, states enacting laws. And as far as the states are concerned, and we have amicus briefs from a number of states that made the trade-off that that we think it's more important to preserve our liberty not to have to engage in or not to have to buy what the federal government tells us than it is to have our citizens beholden to the federal government through subsidies. That's a trade-off a state can make. Maybe they'll pay a political price.
And look, all I'm asking you is give states the option that Congress gave them. The IRS changed the deal.
What you're asking for is, come on, let's put it on the table.
Sure.
What you're asking for is destroy the individual mandate, which guts the statute. That's what this case is about. There's nothing hidden about that. Till this, you kill the individual mandate, and we've got the statute, and we've got what we want. Now, my own personal view, since we're expressing some views here, isn't that a political question? Shouldn't you be in Congress fighting that fight? But that's what this case is about. Got the statute.
That's the key point, right, Judge Edwards? Let's let Congress figure this out. Congress wrote it this way.
Let Congress undo what you say and should not be properly there.
If Congress said, as it expressly did in the clearest possible English, that subsidies are limited to exchange established by the states under Section 1311, and they don't like that result, then all they have to do is change the law.
That's the question.
I know. And you're saying
ambiguity, is an agency free to cure the ambiguity?
No.
No.
Not in these circumstances. Because of Shinseki, but if I can get back to the major point, if the stakes are so high, the reason the stakes have become so high is because the IRS completely altered the incentives for states when they were making the original decision. And if the stakes are high, that is when the court should adhere most closely to the legislative language, because it shouldn't allow agencies to hijack, as the court just put it in Loving, very important economic and politically significant questions. That is when the judiciary's deference to the agency is at zenith, not at its apex.
Can I ask you, I'd like to get your view on it, but I'd also like your opponent's view. Is a state still free to set up an exchange?
Yes.
Even though it has to, the statute reads it has to be in effect by January 1st, 2014. Can they still set up an exchange?
Sure. If you read that provision carefully, the January 1-14 is the date upon which the HHS must act. That's what triggers the HHS requirement. But if there's no prohibition that they come in after January 14, that they're somehow stopped, plus which there's a provision in there that says we won't give grants after January 1, 2015, which strongly suggests that they contemplated states coming in after 2015. HHS has taken the position, for example, the two states that are currently on the fence, that if they get their act in, they can come in. And finally, there would be a very strong...
So there's another solution to the so-called gutting of the statute beyond congressional action. If the IRS rule is vacated, speaking hypothetically, then the 34 states who said it doesn't matter could opt in and set up an exchange, and everybody would go away, and there'd be no issue.
You won't even need a corrective action. We can figure out whether or not I'm right and Congress is right, that states don't behave economically irrational by denying hundreds of billions of dollars to their voters. It would certainly dramatically change the calculus. If you have to tell your voters, I don't want to take on this politically unpopular task of running the exchange, explaining to your voters, because I don't want to do that, you people making up to $95,000 a year aren't going to get a dime in federal subsidies, and you're not going to be able to afford the health insurance that you would if I made a separate decision, I think that will dramatically alter the attitudes of elected officials in those states. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Delery.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. The text and structure of the Affordable Care Act demonstrate that federal tax credits are available to lower the costs of insurance on the 34 federally facilitated exchanges within individual states. The relevant statutory provisions, read together as they must be, preclude plaintiff's interpretation and show that Congress intended a nationwide system to provide affordable health care. Plaintiff's fundamental error is to focus on one phrase in one provision in isolation. The government's reading...
It's not one phrase. I've heard that so many times. At one point, I counted up the number of references to established by a state pursuant to 1311, just in 36B. And I think it appears seven times, not just once.
Right.
Do you disagree with it?
It does appear several times, Your Honor.
Not several, I said seven.
I'm not sure about the exact number, but I know it is several, multiple.
So it's not an isolated phrase in the statute.
Right. So 36BA begins by saying the tax credit shall be allowed in the case of an applicable taxpayer, and then the formula calculates the amount of the credit with respect to income level, not based on which exchange. If you look then at two references in the formula, in B2A and C2A little 1, the phrase says established by the state under 1311 or 42 U.S.C. 18031. So that provision itself includes a cross-reference straight to the nested exchange requirements in Title 42.
In this case with West Virginia, Mr. Klemenchik is from West Virginia. Who established the exchange in West Virginia? Who?
The secretary.
The secretary established the exchange. Right. West Virginia did not establish the exchange.
That's correct, Your Honor. But under Section 18...
So we're parsing this phrase established by the state, right?
I think the phrase is established by the state under 1311,
yeah.
which is a cross-reference. So in order to interpret the plain text of that statute, you need to go to 1311 to see what it says. And that's where the plaintiffs discover the importance of context. So Section 1311 provides that the states shall establish an exchange, as was just discussed. Plaintiffs recognize, however, that is not the end of the story because states have an option under the framework of the statute.
The question isn't what type of exchange it is, right? It's an exchange. It's going to be. The question here is who established it. That apparently that phrase meant a lot to Congress, as Judge Randolph mentioned seven times. Who established it? And by your own admission, the secretary established it.
Right. I think I have two answers to that, Your Honor. The first is to focus on the language of 18041C, which provides that if a state either elects not to establish its own exchange or is unable...
You know, it would be very helpful, and I found your brief a little confusing, if you used either the sections from the Affordable Care Act or the sections from the U.S. Code, and rather than switching back and forth, when you said that, I said, gee, I don't... Okay, you're talking about 1321.
Right. I'm happy to do that, Your Honor. It's 1321, and this appears on page 17A of the addendum, if that's helpful. So that if a state is not an electing state or is unable to establish the exchange, have it operational by the date, which was January 1st, then the secretary shall establish and operate such exchange within the state. And I believe in the prior argument, the phrase such exchange was not referenced by the plaintiffs. They talk about an exchange when, in fact, the statutory term is such exchange, which refers back to the required exchange under 1311.
That can't be the end of it, though, can it? I mean, because if they're establishing an exchange under 1311, then that means the federal government has got to elect state officials, which is rather odd.
Right.
Doesn't 1311 require the election of state officials and so on to administer? We talk about an exchange, but what we're really talking about is an entity formed under state law. The federal government, I don't think, can do that.
I think what these two provisions read together, as they must be, Your Honor, mean is that a state was given the right of first refusal, first option to establish the state, to establish an exchange. If it either chose not to do so or was unable to do so, then the secretary would step in and establish such exchange to accomplish the same functions. And I believe that the plaintiffs can agree on page 5.
The secretary is operating pursuant to Section 1321, which is what you're talking about. The states operate pursuant to Section 1311. So some of the requirements of 1311 apply to the secretary's establishment of an exchange. But still, is it your submission that the phrase, which appears seven times in that statute, established by a state pursuant to Section 1311, means that a federal exchange is established by a state pursuant to 1311? Parse those words for me and tell me where the interpretive view that you're espousing fits within that language?
So make a couple of points. I think the basic point is that the exchange under 1321, where a state has not established an exchange, slots into, provides the function of, is the substitute for the exchange, the state's exchange under 1311, provides the same functions. And I believe that that is the position that the plaintiffs agree with in their reply brief on page 5. So what you really have is a nested series of provisions.
But I'm not getting the language. Established by a state pursuant to 1311 means, as the proposed notice of rulemaking, established by the federal government pursuant to section 1321. I mean, that is a leap. That's not interpretation.
So respectfully, Your Honor, I think if you look at the slotting in of the federal exchange, you get to this result. And exchange is a defined term under Title I of the Affordable Care Act. Section 36B is in the Internal Revenue Code. Exchange established by the state under 1311 is pointing back to the nested exchange provisions in what was Title I of the Affordable Care Act. But for purposes of that provision, exchange is a defined term, meaning an American health benefit exchange under 1311. So when the secretary is directed to establish such exchange, that's such American health benefit exchange under 1311. Congress is clearly indicating that it wants a system of exchanges nationwide to provide affordable health care for all Americans. States have the first opportunity to establish those exchanges under this framework. But if they don't, then that same exchange is created by the secretary.
That's not the same exchange. You have to agree to that.
For purposes of the operation of the statute,
well, it's not the same exchange because 1311 talks about state officials running it and state laws being passed and state budgets being charged with the responsibility with some federal subsidies. So it's not the same thing.
Right. Given the definitional terms, however, the point is that, Your Honor, the secretary's exchange stands in the shoes of, steps into the place of, the defined term.
All you're saying to me is, and maybe I'm just not hearing you, is that you're saying because of 1311, the secretary can establish the type of exchange that's created in 1311. But that begs the question. The key language is, who establishes the exchange? And you just keep coming back to, well, the secretary establishes it.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the key language is
Language is established by the state under 1311.
Under 1311.
And was West Virginia established, the exchange of West Virginia, was it established by the state under 1311?
Okay,
it was established by the secretary pursuant to 1321 as it references, and it's a type of exchange that you would get under 1311 in terms of the marketplace, but it wasn't established by the state.
But the further point, Your Honor, I think, is the secretary, HHS, establishes the exchanges where the state and operates them, where the state does not. But Congress can define terms however it wants. It can set up nested provisions however it wants. It's not that unusual.
Congress did this for territories, right? I mean, in the case of territories, Congress said territories can create these exchanges, and they will be treated like a state. They didn't use that language here. Why not?
The territory provision was needed because of the differing internal income tax provisions that apply there. Here, I would submit, it's in a different form, but it reaches the same result. It has the same effect. That is what Congress did. And if you step back to the point about what the goal of the statute was here, I think it's clear from the text of the statute and from the structure that the purpose was to provide affordable health care to Americans nationwide.
Is that the only purpose? Wasn't there also a purpose to have the states run the exchanges?
I think what the statute reflects is a design of cooperative federalism, so that the states would have the first opportunity, certainly, to run the exchanges, but that if they did not, the federal government would step in and provide them. That's why the term applicable to the states is that the state could elect to establish an exchange for itself, and otherwise the states won't.
Let me give you a proposition I'd like you to respond to. This statute, as everybody knows, was kind of a last-minute deal, and it never went through the usual legislative process of the conference committee and so on and so forth. But there were a lot. The statute is filled with a lot of predictions, even the title. And from all reports, those predictions have not been borne out. The launch was an unmitigated disaster, as everybody agrees. The costs have gone sky high, even though Congress apparently thought that competition in an open market, transparent market, would drive costs down. And let us suppose that Congress made another prediction, and that prediction was that if we allow subsidies on state exchanges without allowing them on federal exchanges, that all the states would line up and buy that deal. And that prediction turned out to be wrong. So as a narrative of what is going on with the Affordable Care Act, where do you disagree?
I disagree with several of the first premises, among other things. There are millions of Americans who have enrolled through exchanges for health care that they otherwise could not have afforded or could not access because of pre-existing conditions. And the structure of the act was to provide an integrated system of reforms that would reform the individual market. So now insurance companies have to cover people no matter how sick they are. And the structure as designed was to bring otherwise healthy people into the insurance market through a combination of the mandate, as was discussed, and the subsidies, which make them affordable. Without the subsidies on the exchange, the exchanges and the insurance markets won't function because the sick people will buy the insurance that they're entitled to. Otherwise, healthy people will not be in the risk pool. The pool, therefore, will be more expensive to insure. Premiums will continue to go up, and the cycle will repeat. That's the death spiral that we and other amici have talked about. Right now, millions of Americans have enrolled and are getting the benefit of tax credits, which are key to provide this affordable health insurance. The plaintiff's counter-narrative, which provides a different purpose.
You left one thing out of the calculation, and that is that Congress acted on the assumption that dangling this carrot in front of the states and the politicians and the governors of the states would lead to the fact that the states themselves would set up exchanges rather than the federal government. And there's some pretty strong evidence of that, because how much was allocated, what was the budget allocated to the federal government to set up exchanges? It was only $304 million, as I recall. And yet at last time I checked, it's cost well over $2 billion. So that the budget allocation appropriation indicated that there wouldn't be, if any, federal exchanges.
I don't think that that's the case, Your Honor, either. Certainly, there were reports at the time that states were considering not establishing exchanges. Obviously, the statute provides that flexibility. The term in the title of the provision is state flexibility. The state is allowed to elect not to. There were reports at the time.
Aren't there only three or four that indicated they were considering not setting one up prior to the IRS rule?
Right. I'm not sure about the exact timing. I think certainly there were some who said that at the time. More now ultimately decided not to do it.
You're not agreeing with the premise that subsidies were a carrot.
No, and I was coming to that, Your Honor. I'm absolutely not. I think it's an after-the-fact account manufactured without evidence from the record at the time. And in fact, there's no credible indication, I would submit, that Congress intended to sacrifice the principal subsidy that would provide affordable care for Americans across the country as an incentive.
Well, because you're going to get the individual mandate, which is the principal prong of the statute.
Right.
And that's what makes sense.
But Congress did do just that, not for everybody, but the people who make below 100% of the poverty figure for a household are not eligible for subsidies. Isn't that correct? Is that correct?
Yes.
It's correct. And the reason for that is that Congress assumed that the states would buy into the Medicare expansion or Medicaid expansion, and they would be covered by Medicaid. But the fact of the matter is that I don't know how many states, was it 19 states, have not bought into the Medicaid expansion. And so all these people that are 100% or less of the poverty are not even eligible for subsidies. Right. Is that right?
In the states that have not yet accepted the Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid expansion, however, was clear in that the additional requirements were made part of the mandatory Medicaid requirements. And a very different situation than here because of the longstanding practice of the Medicaid program. States have been operating the joint program with the federal government under established rules for decades. Here, the plaintiff's proposition is that this incentive, which was supposedly so extreme that states would not be able to refuse it, was buried in subparagraphs like B2A and C2A1 in the formula calculation.
If I gave you a table of contents of the, I don't know how many pages this thing is, but 2,000 pages, and I gave you a table of contents, and I asked you, please find where or who is eligible for a subsidy. What section would you look at? Would you look at the section entitled 36B? Wouldn't that be the very first section you'd look at?
And 36, this is my point, Your Honor. If you look at 36BA, it provides that the tax credits are available to individuals. The tax credits were not intended as subsidies to state or grants to states. They were intended as tax credits to federal taxpayers. It's a relationship between the federal government and the individuals. And if you look at the these provisions in 36B, the title is premium assistance. It indicates what Congress thought the purpose of the tax credit was. It was to provide support to defray the costs of the insurance premiums on the exchanges.
Would you agree with me that 36B, which is what you're talking about, and the way it's structured, is a copy from the Health Coverage Tax Credit Act of 2002? I don't know. Have you looked at that?
I have a while ago, Your Honor. I have not looked at it. And so I don't know the history of whether it was copied for that. My understanding is that provision expired at January 1st of this year.
Yeah, because this takes it over. But right. But the point is that when you're talking about structure, it also begins with the individuals, then it goes down to coverage month, and then it says here's the subsidy at 72%. And then it also says that you don't get it unless your state has enacted the following laws. It's the same deal. But, I mean, the structure of that is the same.
I believe, Your Honor, although, again, I need to double check, I think that provision also included some forms of coverage that were available nationwide. So it's not exactly an analogy to the plaintiff's proposition here. But in addition to premium assistance, which the tax credits were intended to be in 36B, the statute also provided state assistance, and it's in Section 18031. And
what is that under the act?
I'm sorry. It's 1311. Sorry about that, Your Honor. Incentives were provided to states under the cooperative federalism model to establish their own exchanges, grants to assist in the startup costs. Ultimately, then the costs would have to be borne by user fees, and also regulatory authority vested in the exchanges to among other things, define the scope of qualified health plans that be offered through the exchanges. So states, if they wanted to elect to create an exchange, they had an incentive to do it in terms of grants and regulatory authority that they would be allowed to do. But significantly,
was it after 2015 that they're on their own?
The grants expire, and once the exchanges are up and running, they have to be supported through user fees, not through the grant money.
If I were to disagree with you and think that established by the state under 1311 means established by the state, is your argument over?
So I think, Your Honor, no. And there are a few other provisions that indicate that, at the very least, if you disagree that with our reading that that's the plain reading of the statute, at the very least, there's ambiguity and interpretive tension between provisions of the Act that suggests that the interpretation by the agency delegated with the authority to issue the regulations here is entitled to deference. And I point to a few of them. One is the reporting requirements under 36BF3. That statute makes clear that Congress expected the federal premium tax credits to be available on the federal exchange. There's an express reference to the authority of both the exchanges under created by the state under
1311. I think Mr. Carbon's response to that, I don't want to put words in his mouth, is that, well, that was to monitor the individual mandate, right? It wasn't just to check on true-upping premium assistance, but it could also be used to monitor the individual mandate.
I think that's not right, Your Honor. The title of the section is Reconciliation of Credit and Advance Credit. So Congress is saying what the purpose is for. It also expressly contemplates that the exchanges would be, including the federal exchanges, would be providing the tax credits.
This was not part of the Affordable Care Act.
It was added in the PACERA, the reconciliation bill, afterwards. And
it's an amendment to the Affordable Care Act.
Which shows
that you're using to show what was meant in the Affordable Care Act.
I think it shows a confirmation, Your Honor.
Hasn't the IRS backed off that? I thought just recently they just took a different interpretation that kind of undercuts your argument, saying it can't be used for that.
No, Your Honor. I think what IRS...
Maybe Mr. Carbon can address that in his rebuttal.
I think what the IRS recently did is to say that because some of this information might be used for other purposes, they would, as an administrative matter, lessen the burden on insurers to provide information under a different provision. But I don't think, if you're looking at it as a statutory matter in terms of what Congress understood, and that Congress understood that federal exchanges would be providing federal tax credits, that the later change undercuts that at all. And the Medicaid maintenance of effort provision is another example.
The legislative history is a wash, right? I mean you parry and they thrust, or they thrust and you parry. There doesn't seem to be any clear legislative history here showing that this was an item of great concern to Congress, other than the text itself. I realize the text, but I'm talking about the legislative field of legislative history, a field I'm not comfortable going into, but Sierra Club suggests that we need to look at it. But you have a special burden to bear there, don't you? Given the plain language established by the state, don't you have a special burden to show from legislative history that that doesn't mean what it appears to mean?
Isn't the legislative history clear on the importance of the individual mandate?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that there's a legislative history answer, and there's also a statement of purpose that comes from the text structure.
Is there a discussion of the individual mandate that talks about whether the subsidy is conditioned upon being a federal or state exchange? I don't think there's anything to that.
No, but there is a provision. It's in 1501A of the Affordable Care Act, Your Honor, that lists several findings about the operation of the individual mandate. It makes clear that the subsidies were viewed as an integral part of the effectiveness of that program, and that's in the text of the statute. We don't need to resort to legislative history on that point. If you do resort to legislative history, Your Honor, I think.
But how does that undercut Mr. Carver's argument? They needed the individual mandate. They needed the subsidies, and the IRS messed it up. By changing the deal. How does that undercut his argument?
I think that there are several aspects of the again of the legislative history. And I think closely related to text and purpose. I think given that the text itself said what the purpose of the statute was, which was to provide Affordable Care for all Americans. It's in the name of the statute, and it's in the title of Title I.
So that raises an interesting question. If we know a clear purpose of Congress, and yet they don't legislate clearly enough to achieve that purpose, is it our job to fix the problem?
I think what the Supreme Court has said and what this Court has said, so Supreme Court in Brown and Williamson, in Marasich and other cases, and this Court in cases that have been discussed here, have said that in order to answer that question about whether language, you know, what text of a statute means, whether it's clear or whether it's ambiguous, you need to look at all of the canons of statutory interpretation. And in Brown and Williamson, for example, the Supreme Court looked to the structure of the law to identify the overall purpose and concluded that given that, again, looking at text and structure, a potential reading of one provision was off the table. Sure. Because, you know, and so it's the same here.
Do you know of any, let's just stick to the Supreme Court, any Supreme Court cases that stand for the following proposition, that although we have the text of a statute that seems perfectly clear on its face, if we look at another provision and we give that a plain meaning, that other provision we give a plain meaning, then we have an anomaly, and what we have to do is change this, the provision that that seems to be clear, rather than change the provision where, that causes the anomaly. I know the absurdity principle, and but if Congress is Janus faced, if it's pointing in one direction here and one direction there, yet I don't know of any. There's an absurdity principle, but I don't think there's a stupidity principle. If the legislation is just stupid, I don't see that it's up to the court to save it.
I would strongly disagree, Your Honor, with the proposition that that applies here. But I think on the question about a Supreme Court,
or also if there's a political compromise that's struck that may not achieve the total purpose. I mean, there's purposes of statutes, and then sometimes those can be attained, sometimes those can't be attained, and so political compromises are struck. How are we supposed to take that into account? Right. Your argument seems to be there's an overall purpose, and we ought to be hell-bent on pursuing that, and that ought to be our goal. How does that account for the fact that there may be political compromise along the way that detracts from that purpose, but maybe has some ancillary political purpose?
So I think the short answer, Your Honor, I'll come back to it in a second, is that this is not an untethered purpose argument. This is a purpose argument based on the text and structure of the law, where Congress legislated as it did. It spoke the way it did. It set up a system of nested provisions that, when you walk through them, lead to the conclusion that the federal exchange stands in the place of a state exchange where the state elects not to set it up. On the Supreme Court case question, Your Honor, and I'll come back actually to the political compromise point because I want to respond to Mr. Carvin on that. But on the Supreme Court case, I think one that comes to mind is the Marasich case, which, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is one about the Driver Privacy Protection Act. And Justice Kennedy's opinion says, if we look just at this particular provision, it seems to have a very broad scope. Nothing about this paragraph suggests that it wouldn't cover what's at issue here. But if we look at other provisions of the case.
That's a common method. But what we've got here is language that doesn't seem to be malleable in any way, shape, or form for many of the reasons that Judge Griffith mentioned. I mean, it's an exchange established by a state pursuant to 1311 means an exchange established by the federal government pursuant to 1321. The reporting requirement, it seems to me, cuts against you because there, Congress, in amending the statute, recognize the dichotomy between the two different exchanges, one under 1311 and one under 1321. But they didn't with respect to the subsidy eligibility.
I think that's not right, Your Honor. I think the reference to the two provisions, parts of 1311 and 1321, in the parenthetical in 36BF3, I think it demonstrates that Congress expected that the credits would be available on both type of exchanges. But B, those are not those are sub-references to the authority of the exchanges to contract some of the responsibilities of the exchanges to others. It's not speaking, it's not pointing to the state shall establish an exchange provision. It's in there for that particular reason, to point to to make clear that if either of those two sources of authority for contracting is invoked, these reporting requirements still apply. But that would only be, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
it would only make sense for that to be there and for that to be true if the federal exchanges were offering offering tax credits. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Now, there is legislative history in the brief submitted by members of Congress and state legislators pointing to the Senate Finance Committee report. Right. They say, they use the words, yes, to establish, the feds would establish a state exchange.
Right.
And there are three, because everyone understood what was going on, and then there were three House committees,
yes,
who said if that happens, the individuals who would be supported by the subsidy are folks who couldn't otherwise afford it. Nothing to indicate that it was conditioned on who created the exchange. No one assumed that this was what was in play.
I think that that is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And the point about the Senate Finance Committee report, and this reference appears on page 193 of the Joint Appendix, is important to respond to Judge Randolph's question, because I think it shows, and I think this is something that plaintiffs concede they, on pages 6 and 7 of the reply brief, that there is nothing that puts outside that puts it beyond Congress's power to define an exchange established by the state to mean an exchange established by the District of Columbia or the territories or the federal government. The question is, has Congress done that? They would submit that there is some sort of new plain statement rule that says that the way Congress did it is not sufficiently clear. Our position is, if you follow the canons of interpretation as this Court's precedent and the Supreme Court precedent require, you come to the conclusion that Congress intended the Secretary to establish such exchange, which, again, I think is a key statutory term. It doesn't mean it doesn't say an exchange. It means such exchange, suggesting the same. And so at the very least, back to the point about interpretive ambiguity, to the extent that you conclude that our reading is not the only plausible one, although we think it is when you read it all together, it's certainly a natural reading. I would submit the most natural reading and a reasonable reading. And so, therefore, it's entitled to deference under the established precedent.
Mr. Delery,
yes?
Before you sit down, you haven't addressed this, and I don't know that Mr. Carvin did either, but I'd like to ask you. I'm trying to remember that what struck me was you were talking about canons of interpretation, and there's an ancient canon of interpretation that goes back to the 1800s. And I think the Supreme Court case is Yazoo. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah,
and that's the one that says that you whatever this means, and you strictly interpret tax credits or in tax matters and so on and so forth. And that if it's not clear, you err on the side of the federal treasury. That is, you don't give the money. Now, how much? Do you have a response to that?
I do, Your Honor, and there are a couple of them. One is, there certainly are cases, Yazoo and others, that suggest that there's a presumption in some circumstances. Although the court has never said that it's the kind of clear statement rule that the plaintiffs are talking about. And here, there's no question that Congress intended tax credits. This isn't a situation of implying them out of whole cloth. 36B provides for tax credits. There's also, we would submit, more important...
Refundable tax credits.
Refundable tax credits.
Which is a euphemism for subsidy.
Yes. But I think that there's a more important principle reflected again in the Supreme Court's cases that revenue laws are to be construed to provide a nationwide system of tax administration uniform in its application, and that ordinarily, and that's the Irvine case that we've cited in our briefs, and ordinarily Congress is presumed not to tie the effect of a federal statute or benefit on state action. That is in the Mississippi Band of Choctaw case as well. So I think here, given that Congress has provided for tax credits.
Well, I don't know about that last one, because yes, 26 U.S.C. Section 35 does just that with respect to subsidies for health care.
I think that here what you have is that Congress has established, we would submit, stated a purpose in the text to create a nationwide system to provide affordable health care, have delegated to Treasury in 36B sub G the authority to implement the provision, and in particular, the authority to provide rules for the coordination of the credit with the advanced credit program administered by HHS. So here, unlike in some of the other situations.
I understand that. I mean, all questions of government are questions of ends and means. And if you change one, you change the other, too. And that's what we're talking about here.
Right. And I think this goes back to Judge Edwards' point from before. I think that there is no suggestion from the time that the members of Congress understood that this is what the plaintiff's theory is, what these provisions were about. They were about premium assistance for individuals so that they could get affordable health care. And the states at the time, the amicus brief includes a survey of reports of commissions at the time that states decided to whether or not to set up their own exchanges. There's no discussion of this there either. And on the eve of the vote in 2010, as Judge Edwards mentioned a moment ago, three House committees made, and this is at 272 and 273 of the Joint Appendix, published a summary indicating the exchanges, the tax credits were available in all the exchanges. So I think if you look at the bargain that was struck, was to pursue the ultimate goal of providing affordable health care. States were given the opportunity. They wanted to create the exchanges to do that,
but
if not, the states would
do that. The March 12 letter that you all submitted, I was a little puzzled by that. Is it the view of the government that if we were to invalidate the IRS ruling, that its force, that the force of our ruling would apply only to Mr. Klemenchik? Is that the gravamen of this?
I do think, Your Honor, that we think that that should not be the result, but that any remedy should be tailored to the parties withstanding here, and not more broadly. And in fact, I think the plaintiffs' counsel recognizes the appropriate scope of the relief here because they have filed a case.
But if we invalidate an IRS rule, that has broad applicability, doesn't it?
Right.
Do you have any authority for that? Is this a position the government has taken before?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the face of precedent.
Well, no, I disagree, Your Honor. I think that under the APA, the relief should be tailored to the agency action, which
determine that the IRS didn't have the authority to issue this rule, you're saying it would apply only to Mr. Klemenchik? It wouldn't have broader applicability?
Well, again, because
in APA, we do that all the time.
But I think this is not a situation, and this goes to some of the other threshold arguments that we have made, including about the refund action. This is not a situation where, review direct review rulemaking is vested here in this court as a opportunity for regulated entities to come here and sue. Under the provision providing for refund actions, Congress has expressly done the opposite and provided diffuse jurisdiction in all district courts and the Court of Federal Claims. Under 36B, individuals elsewhere will have a claim for the tax refund. They can bring those cases elsewhere, and the Plaintiffs' Counsel recognizes that. So that right now, a case was filed last year across the river in Virginia, four different individuals making exactly the same claim. It's pending in the Fourth Circuit. Argument is scheduled for next month. And so in the ordinary approach of allowing the law to develop where the federal government is concerned in circuits around the country, that would be the ordinary course.
I have to comment on this. I think your filing in our court was highly improper. The fact of the matter is, on page 54 of your brief, you raised the class action question. And then the plaintiffs filed a reply brief responding to that argument on page 54 of the red brief. You don't get a cert reply in this court without asking special leave. And for that letter to come in, as I said, I think it violated the court's rules.
Sorry, I think the intent was to provide a case to the court that seemed to be relevant and understand
was
your position, Your Honor. It was not a new case. It was... obviously,
isn't that what 28 J's are for?
Why don't you just say, respectfully, Your Honor, our argument has been submitted. I'll sit down now.
I will do that, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Carvin, we'll give you 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by answering some of the questions you asked and Judge Randall. First, with respect to the reporting requirement, the government argues there's a bit of a mismatch between the title, which talks about tax credits, and our point, which is obviously the government wants information on all kinds of purchases on the exchanges that are not subsidized. And I think the answer is, as Judge Randall's pointed out, that was an amendment to the PPACA, and so they just sort of stuck it in the relevant provision. But obviously the government has very much interest in who's buying and how much they're paying for on these exchanges, regardless of whether or not they're subsidized. I'd also make the point.
Isn't there another point, Mr. Carvin, about the reporting requirements?
Yeah.
The report goes to the Secretary of the Treasury, but it also goes to each individual citizen. And in the states that have federal exchanges, those people are going to get reports from the federal government saying that your subsidy, we're afraid, is zero. And that puts tremendous political pressure, it seems to me, on the governors and the state legislators in those states who haven't set exchanges.
Just to be clear, it says the report doesn't just go to the secretary, it goes to the taxpayer. So you want to correct factual mistakes, you want to accomplish the point you did. I'll point out it took three declarations from the head of CMS to figure out what Klemenchek's subsidy was. So we need to figure out, we need to have this very accurate check. Their original argument before the latest 28J filing was, oh, we don't need this information from the exchanges, we get it from the insurers. But the IRS just told you we don't care about what the insurers send us because the exchange is the best source of the information. The government erects a cathedral around the word such and say that this somehow changes things. It doesn't change things. All such means is they're not telling the secretary to set up any old exchange, it's such exchange. They want it to replicate as best they can what's in the state, but all that tells you is what kind of exchange is, and 36B doesn't turn on what kind of exchange it is, it turns on who established the exchange. So when HHS establishes such exchange, then obviously it is not the state that is establishing such exchange. The key point I want to make, because I don't think we made it clearly in our brief, is if you look at the provision saying that territories shall be treated like states, that's 1323 of the Act. There it says territories shall establish such exchange, the 1311 exchange, and be treated like a state. So we know that no one in Congress thought that such exchange meant be treated by like a state because of the territorial provision. In response to Judge Randall's question about whether or not if you find it absurd in Section X, whether you can sort of transport that to Section Y, I think probably the best answer is Duke Energy, which is at 127 Supreme Court 1423. And they say normally we presume that the language means the same in differential provisions, but they didn't in that case because there was contextual differences. Well, obviously, if your rationale for not interpreting state to mean state in one provision is state can't mean state because it's absurd, that provides you no justification for not interpreting state to mean state, whereas in 36B, it doesn't lead to a absurd result. In terms of whether or not you stop at the plain language, Judge Griffith, I agree you do look at other canons of construction, but one canon of construction, which is ancient, but is used frequently by this court. Judge Tatel, in 1997, said we are not granting tax credits unless they are established unequivocally and conclusively. So you never get to Chevron because if there is ambiguity in the granting of the tax credit in these circumstances, then the government loses because the canon resolves it, not the agency. He says there's a canon for a nationwide system. We are advocating a nationwide system. The same rule applies in every state. You get the subsidy, the tax credit, if you go on an exchange established by the state. That's nationwide, just like saying you get a tax credit if you go to an accredited institution. The fact that only a subset of the citizenry takes advantage of it doesn't mean that we've created some kind of dual system. Finally, in terms of this whole legislative history debate, I don't think this court or the Supreme Court could have been any clearer that if the statute says X,
That's the end of the inquiry. You don't go fishing around legislative history. But if you did engage in that activity here, you wouldn't find a scintilla of legislative history in any way contradicting or undermining the plain language. They're making a dog doesn't bark argument, that it doesn't echo the plain language of the statute. But surely no one's ever required legislative history that repeats verbatim the statutory language, and they can't point to a scintilla of legislative history to support their completely atextual interpretation of 1321, which for the first time in American history would mean that state means federal. Unless there are further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.